Welcome to Job Tales, the show where we find out about different professions from the people who know. Each week, I'll speak to a new guest with an inspiring job. We talk to photographers, behavioral scientists, doctors, pianists, you name it. We hear about their professional path to doing what they do, the skills that are required, and the tools they use for the job, plus a couple of suggestions for you. I'm Laura Lucini, and today my guest is Adam Baer. I initially asked Adam to talk about his job as a voiceover artist, but then I discovered that he has worked for many, many years in animatronic puppetry, which I find very unique. So here's Adam and his two job tales. Adam Baer, thank you for being my guest at Job Tales. Very funny how we met and very interesting what you do. Voiceover artist. Now, I've learned by talking to you just yesterday that you did something else before then. I'm also very interested in understanding that part of your career and your life before voiceover. So can you tell me what you did before? And then we get to the voiceover just in a few minutes.
Sure. So what I did before, I was involved with makeup effects and animatronic puppetry. Mm. And what's, for those that are not familiar with the term, animatronic puppetry is actual live creatures that are in film and television, like aliens or aliens in Stargate or some of the animatronic animal puppets that were in movies like Cats and Dogs, etc., that are very realistic and they usually have mechanical devices inside, like motors and robotic elements, and also mixed with traditional puppetry mechanics inside. Mm. So I did that for professionally from about, I was just a teenager when I started. Wow. And so I was in the 80s, and I did my last movie in animatronics in 2008. So
it
was about probably close to 30 years that I was involved with that.
Amazing. And yeah, you were a teenager then. So how did that happen that you got into animatronic puppetry?
Well, when I was a child, I saw the Star Wars movies and was incredibly taken with them and looked at the creatures. And I'd always been interested in puppets and stuff, but when I looked at the particular creatures in Star Wars, and then later Aliens came out, etc., this would have been in the sort of late 70s, early 80s. Mm. And, you know, as just a child, I was awed by it. And I thought, this is exactly what I would like to do for a living. And as a child in Johannesburg, you know, South Africa, there was a film industry, but there wasn't a huge amount of opportunity to build a career in those fields. So I started experimenting with it. And when I was a university student, I joined a special effects studio in Johannesburg. It was one of the only ones that sort of specialized in that sort of thing. And I got a job there as an intern and later as an assistant. And I was lucky enough to work on a couple of American films that were being filmed there with some of the great practitioners of that art, like Steve Johnson's XFX. I was lucky enough to work on one of the Howling movies, you know, later other things. And I started building my own characters for commercials and so forth. And then I also, when I was at university, I majored in puppetry, and I was lucky enough to study, that was one of my majors. And I was lucky enough to study with the Handspring Puppet Company, who are South African. They're very, very well-known puppeteers and puppet designers. And internationally, they're known for building the horses in the that show in the West End. What was it called again about the Second World War? Incredible horses that were very lifelike in their movement and so on.
I forget the name of the show now. War Horses?
War Horse, that's right. Mm. Yes. And so I learned a lot of, even though a lot of their specialty was in the theater, I learned a lot about the performance end of puppetry from them. I was very fortunate to study with them. They're absolutely brilliant. And then I started working in films and eventually moved to Canada in my 20s and pursued my career there. And then I was lucky enough to work on shows like The X-Files and Stargate and, the Alien movies and many, many films. I think I've done over 100 or 150 different productions in those fields, makeup effects and animatronics. I was the head puppeteer on Ninja Turtles TV series, head puppeteer on the new Addams Family, you know, head puppeteer on Santa Claus, the Santa Claus 2, Alien versus Predator, Requiem, many, many shows like that. I was very active politically in the union in Canada, and I got into a position as the head of the puppeteering department in British Columbia, part of the Actors Union of Canada. So I got involved with developing a core of puppeteers in Canada, in Vancouver, and a lot of the big animatronics companies from Los Angeles, like Jim Henson Company and Amalgamated Dynamics and Character Shop, etc., sort of put me in the position of their local supervisor. And I ended up developing a core group of Canadian puppeteers, which is what I'd promised the Canadian government if they gave me a work permit right in the beginning, that I would pass on a lot of these skills. So that's how that career sort of developed. And as a tail end of it, I was lucky enough to work with some of my, you know, the people that were heroes to me when I was a kid. One of my supervisors, a top person in the puppet world, film puppet world, called David Barkley, who built Jabba the Hutt for Star Wars. He also did a lot of the building of Yoda, puppeteered on, you know, everything from Dark Crystal to a lot of the Henson films to, you know, all these iconic films. And he was my supervisor on a couple of films that we did, Cats and Dogs films, Snow Dogs, etc. And, you know, incredible honor and incredible learning curve working with him and the puppeteers from the Henson Creature Shop as well. So amazing. It was an amazing, amazing arc of career that went on for many, many years.
Wow. When you say I was lucky to work here and there, like, what does the luck consist of? Because, of course, you're not just lucky per se, you know, like the movie producer, you know, just comes to you and say, hey, would you want to work? How did you build in your reputation and how did that luck happen?
Well, with regard to some of the, like working with David Barkley, a bunch of the puppeteers in Canada had to audition for that particular kind of puppetry. So I was chosen very fortunately by means of audition. So I passed the audition. And on the first Cats and Dogs movie, I think I was the only full-time Canadian puppeteer. So when you say luck, I think that a lot of the people who are in those fields start off the same way. They're very passionate about it. They spend a lot of time and energy developing the skills, and they recognize passion and commitment and diligence and discipline, I think, is probably one of the factors in younger people coming in who want to be on the team. Mm-hmm. And I had done quite a lot of work on my own as well. Like in South Africa, I imported a lot of the materials from the US myself. I was the only person using them. And in fact, at one point, the Handspring, when I was a university student still, the Handspring Puppet Company engaged me as a consultant for this one kind of foam latex that they were using for television puppets at the time. So I was sort of ahead of many people in the technical areas as well. And I was building my own animatronics just based on things I'd seen in films and books and not really having any direct mentors. So I think some of the people kind of recognized this, and they also appreciated the fact that I'd had formal training in performance, in puppetry, and all those things together. And of course, you know, you have to get along with them, your personality, etc. So all the things combined. Plus, I think, to be honest with you, I think the fact that I was so politically active was a factor. There was a couple of productions that had disputes between the Producers Association and the Actors Union over the category of animatronic puppetry for on the union contract. And I was involved in some of those court cases and mediations and was instrumental in furthering the cause of puppetry. And then I got put in a position where when puppeteers were coming into Canada, there were certain criteria, like all people coming in, actors, technicians, etc., that had to be sort of checked and considered by the various unions and by immigration. And I was pulled into a lot of those discussions as an advisor. And I think the people in LA knew that, and they appreciated the fact that I was knowledgeable enough to be considering their best interests, if that makes sense. And I also was considering the union's best interest. So I was in a mediation position that was very helpful to everyone, I think.
I want to just go back on the what makes you an animatronic puppeteer. So you need to know, I guess also you studied this at the university when you were majoring. You need to know the mechanic of it. You have to build a puppet from scratch. You need to play in it. Or how is your interaction with the puppet? And what do you need to know in order to, yeah, okay, to be the animatronic? Yeah, just right, from a layman perspective.
Sure. There's quite a few people involved. Usually there's a big creature shop where they build all the puppets. And in that creature shop, there's a whole range of kinds of different kinds of technicians, sculptors, designers, painters, people who make molds, people who make fiberglass skeletons and mechanical skeletons, people who do the robotic installations, people who do programming for the robotic installations, people who build eyes, people building teeth, etc. On a movie like Alien versus Predator, the creature shop involved probably had 60 or 70 or more people working at once, doing all the building. And then you get the performance team. So the performance team is usually a mixture of some of the lead people who were involved in the build, and then some of the people like who they would get on location or bring from Los Angeles, who are specialized in specifically in performance. And they know how the puppets work. They're familiar with the mechanisms. They're familiar with the things you have to know to move them in the right way and so on, but they're not builders themselves. So it's a real mix of people coming together to make these things happen. And then, of course, there's a lot of management. When I was in Canada, some of the LA creature shops put me in charge of hiring all the Canadian puppeteers. I had to run auditions and things like that. I also had to receive the puppets from Los Angeles, make sure that they were unloaded correctly, make sure they were put, you know, in storage in the workshops that they were going to be using for the filming. And also the people who are going to be inside creature suits, I often had to pick those people and run auditions and choose all those people as well, and also access the workshop personnel. So there's a lot of management. You're almost like a small scale producer on location for that department on behalf of the creature shop that's going to be coming up from LA with the puppets and their personnel.
When you said that you auditioned, what was your role when auditioning? What were you auditioning for? Manager or performer?
When I was auditioning to be a performer, the puppet supervisor would bring a puppet to the audition, and then you go in and you put the puppet on, or it goes on your hand, or it's your hands going to controls or whatever the puppet is. And they ask you to do certain movements. They say, can you make him look sad? Can you do this? Can you, you know, they give you the same as they would to an actor.
I see.
And then when I was running the auditions, like, for example, I remember one particular situation with Santa Claus 2, the characters who had to be inside the toy soldier outfits, they looked like big plastic toy soldiers. I was actually running auditions with performers who I would blindfold, because some of the suits required situations where they wouldn't be able to see out of them. So I would run them through all the different kinds of movements and performance types that they would be encountering when they were inside those suits. And then I would choose a team of however many were required from all the applicants. But they're all professional performers. So I'd be in a big warehouse with a video guy and everything, running those auditions for, you know, however long it took, a week, a few days, 2 weeks, etc., before the puppets and everybody came up from Los Angeles.
You know, I'm fascinated because, you know, you did about 30 years of this. So of course, you became really good at it and you have to be really specialized. And then now it's been, I don't know how many years, you have switched to something completely else. Although, you know, you may argument that it's still in the arts and, you know, film industry or advertising. And so you do voiceover. So when did that happen and how was the switch?
So what happened was, in about the early 2000s, well, let me start here. A lot of the time when I was doing the puppetry, we would do the, what they call the scratch voice. So that's the voice on set while you're doing the puppetry with the actors, with the other actors. And I would use my own voice, or the other puppeteers would use their own voice. And then later in post-production, they would get a celebrity voice to lip sync, to go over timing and everything that you'd done. And so they could say, you know, Tobey Maguire or whoever it is in the movie, and they put their name on the poster. And I mean, a lot of them are fantastic voice actors as well. So they would do that. And so I'd been doing the scratch voice on set, and I am a trained actor as well. I trained in voice and acting and all that, but okay. I'd never really done that much of it. And I'd always been interested in doing more voiceover work, more cartoon work. So in the early 2000s, I noticed that the creature effects work was slowly being taken over by digital. So a lot of the practical creatures were being replaced by digital animation. And there's a whole film on Jurassic Park on how that process took place. And so I thought to myself, okay, I think this particular field has a lifespan, and I have to start thinking about what I would like to do. I was still doing very, very well out of puppetry at that point.
Right.
It's very highly paid, et cetera. And I thought to myself, let me think about what career I'd like to pursue after this. And I'd have to start training at the same time as I was doing films, et cetera. So I really wanted to do voiceover. So I started studying with local teachers in Canada. There's very, very good people there. And also with top teachers in Los Angeles. My voiceover coaches there, Nancy Wolfson for commercials and narration, Maurice Tobias, who's a phenomenal coach as well. I studied with Don LaFontaine, the famous movie trailer guy, the movie trailer guy, and a few other people in every area of voiceover, animation, narration, commercial, promos, trailers, etc. And then in, I think it was about 2004, 2005, I built a recording studio in my home in Canada, and I started slowly building up a business so that I could take about 4 or 5 years to build a voiceover business, and then I'd be in a position to do that rather than just relying on films. But it actually happened sooner. I think by 2006, 2007, I was already making a living out of voiceover. And then I did my last film as a puppeteer, I think in 2008, somewhere around there. Okay. And then the voiceover just continued ever since.
Oh, fantastic. No, it's a great story because, you know, some people might be afraid of starting something new or thinking, okay, this is, you know, what's going to happen 20 years from now and things change, the market changes. And was it ever a bit nerve-wracking, the idea of, that you may not have the same job in the future or that you had to reinvent yourself, or did it just come naturally?
Well, I think it is for everybody. You know, even a lot of the big stars in Hollywood get into a situation when nobody's hiring them and so forth. Fortunately, that never happened with me. But, you know, I kind of was used to hustling. There's a lot more voiceover in the world than there is puppetry. But there's also a lot more people that you're competing with. So, you know, I really put a lot of energy into marketing and into developing my skills with top teachers. And I was always doing workshops and things and more demos. And I spent quite a lot of money on education and on equipment early in the field. And I was also, I think at that time, the early 2000s, mid-2000s, the whole online world of voiceover was just ramping up. So I kind of got in at a good time. And I started developing an online career because, you know, I had a foreign accent in Canada. And even though I do lots of different accents, there's a perception that you're a foreigner. So I started building up this international career, getting agents in different countries and doing a lot of the work remotely the way that we do now. And so by the time like COVID happened and the pandemic and people started working remotely, I'd been doing it for like 15, 16 years already. So that's the kind of world that I started building just because of exactly what you say, just making sure that you have lots of different places where you can get work from. And lots of different relationships. I have about 15 or 16 agents in different places in the world. And clients are all over the place. So, you know, it is a business that is constantly changing. We've got AI now, and that's changing by the week. Initially, they thought, oh, well, AI is just going to take over all the voice work. But it's actually changed into a completely different picture, which I can talk about separately. But I never really worried about it. I think all the energy that people might have put into worrying, I put into trying to, you know, market myself and get clients and that sort of thing.
And are you able to, you know, live off your voiceover career, like fully?
Yeah, I've been living off my voiceover career very well since the late, like 2007, 2008, somewhere around there. And in fact, the last year or two has actually been some of my best years. But I've always made a living out of it. And it's always been very busy. I'm very, very grateful that that's happened.
Fantastic.
But, you know, it is because I've spread my wings far. And also because I do a lot of different kinds of voiceover work. Not everybody does.
Like, for example, like in terms of commercials, narrative, books, and,
yes,
and so
exactly.
forth.
Yes, exactly. All those different kinds. But also, I do lots of different kinds of accents and different characters and things. So, you know, between all the different kinds of voiceover and all the different kinds of characters that I'm able to play, one of the things that attracted me to puppetry over acting is that I can, you know, if you're an actor, I'm a 6 foot tall man. It's very difficult for me to play a little girl or a monkey or whatever it is. But if you're a puppeteer, you can play all those characters. And as a voiceover artist, you can also play a lot of characters that you don't, you're not limited by what you look like. If
That's
you
so
can
true.
Change your voice to a very wide degree.
And what do you think that really helped you most in your career shift? Like, how did you get your first jobs, for example?
Well, I would like to say, which is probably true, just slogging it out, doing hundreds and hundreds of auditions, never getting any work. And then eventually you get one job for $50, you know, and it sort of builds up from there. But I would say that what's given me the most, besides the perseverance, which is a very big factor with any of these things, I would say that choosing the right teachers and not being afraid to spend money on top level tuition and on top level equipment and courses and things like that is a very big factor. I remember when I did a workshop with Don LaFontaine, there were a few of us in it. It was all top guys and me, who was the new guy. It was $2,000 a day. And he gave that money all to charity because he used to make $15 to $20 million a year out of doing movie trailers.
Incredible.
And yeah. So, you know, that was a lot of money. That was back in, I can't remember exactly, but it's probably 20 years ago or something like that. And it's a lot of money today, and it was a lot more money back then.
Yeah.
So you've got to be, and I got an enormous amount of benefit out of those couple of days, and that have got me a lot of trailer work. So you've got to be prepared to step into it as a profession and, you know, give it your best shot financially and effort-wise. A lot of people kind of see it as a sideline. When, you know, an actor's sort of sometimes moonlighting, doing a little bit of voiceover work, but that's all mostly gone now. The voiceover business now is dominated by professionals who do it all the time and who are fighting it out with each other for the top work.
If you could, you know, look back at your years, you know, from the puppetry to voiceover, is there a lesson that you can take from the past that you've learned that others, you know, who is listening today can benefit from, especially the younger crowd, you know, young women and young men?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One of them is never, ever give up. If you really have got these two ideas are going to actually contrast with each other. One of them is never give up if you're truly passionate about something. But on the other hand, if you can see that not from the position of your ego, where you kind of going, oh, God, I'm never going to make it. And, you know, where you kind of feel down, not from that point of view, but from an objective observation of the market. It's like being in the basketball business. If you can be a top basketball player, but if you're only 5'7", you're not going to be in the NBA. So you've got to balance those kinds of, you know, a real assessment of honesty about what you're doing. And also, you know, there's a guy called Alex Hormozy, who's a very successful businessman and podcaster who's online, who talks about why not specialize in what you're good at instead of trying to have lots of different ways to make a living. So if you find that you're good in one niche area, like when I started voiceover, one of my agents in LA said, look, we'll take you on, but you know, you don't live in America, and also you've got a foreign accent. and we're not sure how this is going to go, but you know, we like you and we think you've got some abilities, so we'll take you on and we'll see. And just a few months later, you know, in those days, all the actors used to go into the agency and they would record all the auditions in the agency recording studio that was inside the talent agency. And it was just a few months later, or less than a year later, where they sent out a mail to everybody saying, anybody who doesn't have a home studio is off the books. And also, they started getting a lot more international work, both from Los Angeles looking for international types of voices, and also work from, you know, through LA casting, but, you know, for different markets and so on. So my brand at the time, which was to get a stronghold in the area of international type voicing and a few different areas, mid-Atlantic, et cetera, as they call it, you know, which wasn't popular when I started, that started to grow and grow and grow. And eventually I built even though I, you know, work in American accents and all different other accents, and a lot of my work is in US accents and other, you know, accents, but having a global type of voice has served me very nicely and specializing it. And also, there's something else I want to say to the young people who are looking at this. There's no substitute for practice.
It's a good one.
In the
one,
book,
yeah.
Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, he talks about having 10,000 hours in a particular area of expertise in order to gain mastery. Mm. And I would say that that's definitely true. You've really got to spend a huge amount of time doing this. Alex Hormozi says the same thing. He says the reason he's good at sales, it's not because of his personality. He's done 4,000 sales, sales campaigns or whatever it is, but just the amount of practice and the things that you learn doing it. So I would say to young people, push hard, try your best, get the best training, get the best equipment you can afford, and then put all your energy into it. And just remember that the people you're competing against are working harder than you are.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Adam. Very wise words. And next time we'll talk about how AI is reshaping the voice of our work. But
sure.
It's super interesting. Yeah. Thanks and good luck with the rest of your career.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Laura. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Adam Baer, voiceover and animatronic puppetry artist. If you'd like to listen to this episode again or more from the JobTales series, then go to worldradio.ch/jobtales or search JobTales wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Laura Leoncini and I'll be back next week for another episode of JobTales with a brand new guest, same time, next week on WRS.